So coming up then, we're going to get to the story of Perpetua, early third century Christian martyr, and the vision that she had of the ladder to heaven. It's so amazing if you've never heard the story. And then also we'll wrap up this concept about the reincarnation piece. Did it originate with Jesus and his followers, this vague reference to, you know, who do the people think I am? Do they think I'm Elisha? And go back to what is a very strange piece in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And then we're about an hour away from your calls, where you can join the conversation too with Dr. Bart Ehrman, the author of Heaven and Hell, A History of the Afterlife, on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett. So, Dr. Bart Ehrman, we are very much enjoying the conversation, and I'm on Twitter. People are following it, and they're jumping with comments, too. So I think it'll be a lively last hour on the way. But let's talk about that strange. I mean, it's not strange, but it's unexpected in the Dead Sea Scrolls, where it seems to indicate the return, the reincarnation, and maybe that's not the way to look at it, of one of their treasured leaders of the past in the community at Qumran.
Yeah, so I'm not completely sure which passage you're talking okay. about. I think the one you're referring to, though, is one that's highly problematic, not just because of the interpretation, but because it's a little piece. Correct me if this is not what you're talking about. There's a little piece, a little fragment that actually has been worn out so much over the centuries that there are holes in it. And when scholars tried to reconstruct this piece, they had to fill in what was in the gaps, because, you know, letters were missing.
Right.
And when they filled it in, so it sounded like this person was going to be raised from the dead, and that this was an anticipation of the Christian expectation of Jesus being raised from the dead. And when scholars re-looked at this thing, they thought, you know, actually, the only evidence that this is somebody coming back from the dead are the letters that some scholar put back in there. And you could put different letters in there. You see what I mean? They're restoring the text, and the key words are precisely the ones that are missing, and so we're not sure if those were the right words or not.
Fair enough. I mean, I am basing this on previous conversations, because as it intersects your current text, lots of these things have come up over the years from Dead Sea Scroll scholars who look for the aspects of the scrolls which they think are new and sort of unexplored. That was one of them we had. And of course, the way you referenced Enoch makes me want to go back to that apocryphal book as well, because of the Watchers, which is just, you know, endlessly fascinating references. And you have an interesting take on that too. So before we move on, can you address the Watchers and Enoch real quick?
Yeah, no, so First Enoch is a book. It's not in the Bible, but it's a very popular book in Judaism at the time of the New Testament. And the first 36 chapters is from a book that scholars call the Book of the Watchers. And it's the reason it's fascinating is because it's a kind of extended story about one of the most peculiar passages of the entire Bible, Genesis chapter 6, right before the flood. We're told that the angels of God, the sons of God, looked down on the daughters of men and saw that they were beautiful, and so they came down and cohabited with them. In other words, these angelic beings came down and had sex with women, and the offspring were these giants. And that's one of the reasons God flooded the world. So people don't know this because they don't read this passage very carefully.
Right.
God flooded the world because these giants are here, and he had to get rid of them. And so that's why you get Noah's flood, one of the main reasons. And so this Book of the Watchers is like an extended 36-chapter discussion of this story and who these angelic beings were. He had actually named them, and you know what they did and why it was so awful, and then how God's punishing them. And this is God is now, you know, they're in places of torment, and this is kind of a prelude to what's going to happen to people, that they too are going to be subject to judgment. And so you start getting within Judaism the idea that after death there will be punishment for souls. And so most Jews at the time of Jesus believed in a resurrection of the body, as Jesus did. Some had started to adopt this more Greek view that your soul could be separated from your body, and the soul could be punished or rewarded after death. And the Book of the Watchers is one of the places where you get that.
It's amazing. And just to close the loop on that previous piece too, somebody just said it to me because they knew the reference I was making, that even in modern Judaism, there are still beliefs in what they call the revolution of souls, that souls would revolve, and whether or not that's a kind of transmigration of souls in the way we would think about a reincarnation or not, this is part of what is some people would argue is in a couple of the hymns that are included in the Dead Sea Scrolls. But I didn't want to get in the weeds on that, but that's why I brought it up earlier. So, but let's talk about Perpetua, because I mean, her story, the story of her martyrdom, is often references her great sacrifice. The most people know the part about, I guess, her offering her neck to one of the wild beasts, that she was so fearless about death because of her belief in the afterlife, that she was perfectly willing not only to die, but that she hastened her own death when it wasn't coming fast enough. But she had a vision, and she wasn't even really, I mean, I say very good. She hadn't been a Christian for very long. She was still a catechumen. She was still learning the tenets of the belief when she had this vision, right?
Right. So Perpetua was, she's living around the year 200, about 100 years after the New Testament. She's living in North Africa, and we have an account of her martyrdom. And it's an interesting account because about half of it claims actually to be a diary that she kept in prison prior to her martyrdom, where she explains what's happening to them and some incidents from her life. And if the diary is authentic, then it's our earliest definite writing by a Christian woman. If it's not authentic, then it's not.
Right. Bottom line.
Yeah. So... right. So she's in prison, and she has several dreams that she describes in this diary that either she herself is describing or that an author claiming to be her is describing. And one of them is, in fact, this vision that she involving a ladder that she's going to go up to heaven. But it's
the nature of that ladder is so fascinating in the vision.
Well, so they're all worried. They're going to die, you know. So what's going to happen? And you know, are we going to be martyred, or are they going to let us off, or what's going to happen? And she prays that God will tell them, you know, are we going to face our death, or are they going to release us? And she has this vision. And so in her vision, there's a ladder that she sees, and she comes up to, and it's the ladder goes up to heaven. But this ladder, on either side of it, has all of these fierce weapons. It has things that will cut you. It'll be swords and daggers and spears, and like going up this ladder is really dangerous. And at the bottom of the ladder, to get onto the ladder, is there's a dragon. Which represents the devil. And she comes to the ladder, and she looks up, and she sees one of the other people arrested with her, their teacher, who's up on top of the ladder, who urges her to come up. And she steps on the head of the dragon, and she climbs up the ladder carefully, avoiding all of the swords and daggers, and she arrives in heaven by going up the ladder, and there's an old man who's milking a sheep, and he gives her, and it's Jesus, And he gives her some milk from the sheep in her cupped hands, and she drinks it with all the crowd of the martyrs up there. And then she wakes up and she realizes that they are going to be martyred, that they're going to. And so the point of the latter vision is she steps on the head of the dragon, meaning she conquers the devil, and she avoids all of the threats to her getting up to heaven, the swords and the daggers and the spears. She avoids those threats, which would be if she recanted her faith, if she decided to go ahead and make a sacrifice to the emperor or to do whatever she had to do to get off the hook, then she wouldn't be able to go up to heaven. And so she avoids all that. It's very difficult to get to heaven, but it's definitely worth it in the end. And so that's her vision.
And so here, in order, I'd love to hear your comment on this, that the ladder itself is very narrow, so it's impossible for two people to go up side by side.
That's a really good point, because everybody has to get to heaven on their own.
On their own.
Point,
and
yeah.
I think you used the word treacherous, that the path to heaven is treacherous. And yeah, we don't think of it that way, right? We think of almost like beam me up, Scotty, you know, it's kind of like the, and it's, it, but it isn't. And it actually speaks to the fact that for most of the Bible or in most instances of the Bible, a visit from an angel itself was pretty treacherous.
Yeah, pretty terrifying, apparently. Yeah.
Yeah.
So she's writing this in the year 200, when Christianity is a persecuted religion. This is one thing most people misunderstand. Christianity was not declared illegal in the Roman Empire. There were no laws against it. But in local areas, some governors, some rulers of local areas would think that Christians were troublemakers, or that they were, you know, they were upsetting the traditional gods, and the gods were angry, and it's going to be bad. And so they would persecute Christians, and sometimes, not often, but sometimes they would martyr them. That's another misconception.
In the arenas, though, in the Colosseums, that actually would happen.
It didn't happen a lot. But what they would do is, like, we have instances of people being thrown. It's got to be put in the context of the Roman entertainments.
Right.
You know, so, you know, they didn't have movies, and so entertainments would be things sometimes like taking prisoners who were condemned to death and putting them in an arena and setting loose wild animals on them and watching what happens. And they apparently thought that was, you know, before they had NFL football, they would do that.
Right, exactly.
And so the Christians who are being martyred are being treated that way. They are being sometimes, and in the case of Perpetua, that's what happens: is they're thrown to the beasts, and to be to be attacked by and to be killed that way.
Live.
So being a Christian was treacherous, and
yeah,
and if you left, and so getting to heaven was not easy, because you know you had to, you know, most people didn't have to face this threat, but some did, and they had to decide what to do, and a lot of people caved in and said, okay, well, I'm not really going to stay a Christian any longer, but you know, some people stayed true to it, and this tradition that Perpetua did, and the idea of getting to heaven is that it's a very treacherous thing. It's not the easy route.
And that speaks to a perception that was common, I believe, which was that you were much like any esoteric group or a subgroup. They thought anybody who in the end chose life or comfort over their faith, they couldn't. There was a big debate on whether or not they could come back to the group if they denied their Christianity in front of, say, some centurions who were like, "You're one of those Christians, and we're going to take you." No, oh, no, I'm not. And so that was that idea of staying on the path, no matter what the consequences, reflected kind of a Christian social belief.
It did, and it had huge implications for the history of earliest Christianity, because, you know, what do you do with these people who
right.
get off the hook and then want to come back in. And what happens if one of those people who gets off the hook is your local bishop?
Right.
You know, who, you know, do you allow him to remain a church leader or not? And if you say he can't be a church leader, are you saying that, in fact, he wasn't ordained by God? And if he wasn't ordained by God, then is anything that he did while he was a bishop, is that effective? Like, if he baptized people, is the baptism still effective or not? I mean, it had all these ripple effects that you wouldn't imagine, but it has to do with, you know, are you going to be faithful in the face of death or not?
We're talking about perceptions of the afterlife that are and aren't in the Bible, but also in religious traditions. And Dr. Bart Ehrman, in the book, when you mentioned the part about Jesus, the vision of Perpetua, that he was old, that he wasn't the you know, the Kenny Loggins Jesus that some people would, you know, picture him as, and he was an old man who gave Perpetua the sheep's milk, and that was interesting.
Yeah, but it's because it's interesting in the Bible, because we always think of him as a young man. But in the Bible, he's also portrayed as the Alpha and the Omega, meaning he's the beginning and the end. And there are passages in the Bible where he's portrayed as being ancient because he existed before the universe came into being.
Right.
He's been around for a long time. And so so you do get that portrayal sometimes of him as old. This is one of those places, obviously.
Well, then in the references in the New Testament written in Greek was the original Grecian formula. They gave him a little.
That's it.
Thank you. So again, we're in this concept is, you know, the things that people often associate again with what's in the Bible really often comes back down to things like the Book of Revelation. And how even the Book of Revelation, well, fine, everything we've already said up until this point, it all changes by the time we get to Revelation. And I think this is a good time to address that fact that, in fact, even Revelation wasn't about individuals. It still, too, was about the collective.
So Revelation is the most fascinating and widely misunderstood book of the entire Bible, which is saying a lot because most of the Bible
right.
is misunderstood, but Revelation especially. And we're going to be seeing a lot of the interpretation of the book of Revelation
yeah.
pretty soon because people who are denying the pandemic are going to start affirming, far-right Christians are going to start affirming it and using the book of Revelation to show it was all predicted. And that started already.
Well, yeah, and I've already had a couple of these conversations too with people, and they've said, you know, doesn't this fit perfectly in the prediction of
yeah.
Revelation? Like saying, no, it doesn't actually fit it at all.
Yeah.
And as I mentioned last night, I think this has more to do, if we want to look at a part of the Bible that has something to do with, it's actually, it's the, you know, it's the idea of predicting the need to have 7 years in our storehouses to survive a crisis.
Yeah, right. Yeah, that's why everybody's stockpiling, getting those 7 years of supplies in there. So, yeah, you know, my next book, I should have written it first, is about misinterpretations of the book of Revelation as predictions of what's going to happen in our future. My book is going to be about both on the religious side, how conservative Christians have argued that it's predicting what's going to happen in as a blueprint for, you know, the 21st century, when in fact it's not that. But I'm also going to talk about how that's affected American cultural and social and even political life, this idea that Armageddon is coming soon. It's going to be all based on it's going to be showing why the apocalyptic movement that we're familiar with from the 70s and 80s and actually starting back in the 1940s all comes from the Christian tradition seeping into popular culture.
We'll leave it right there for a second. I'm going to hit pause when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we'll pick it up right there. A preview of the next Bart Ehrman book. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. So we were just talking about the Book of Revelation and an overwhelming belief, I think, by some people that large parts of the Bible were inexplicable to people of the day that they didn't know what it meant, and that they would, you know, they were hoping sometime in the next 2,500 years somebody would quote unquote decode it. And this is not the view of mainstream biblical scholars, who would say, in fact, it was the opposite. The readers of the book of Revelation understood exactly what it was about, or the book of Daniel understood exactly what the point was. And that's why the books are included in the canon of the Old and New Testament, not because they were confused by it and said, well, better throw it in there because someday somebody will know what this means.
Yeah. Well, that Yeah, obviously, as a biblical scholar, that is absolutely my view. And the way to figure out what the ancient view was is to see what ancient people said about the book of Revelation or the book of Daniel. And, you know, the reality is nobody in the ancient world said, you know, we don't know what this is talking about, but we're hoping in a couple thousand years somebody will have it figured out.
Right. Right.
they certainly thought they knew what it was talking about, and I'm not saying they were right, but about in their interpretation. But the idea that it was all a mystery and that it was meant to be unpacked later, that idea actually developed over time. When people started realizing that, when they started thinking that that in fact this is a book of prophecy predicting what's going to happen in our day, and then the question is, well, if it's talking about what's going to happen, you know, in the year 1983 or in the year 2025, if it's talking about something like that, then why didn't people realize it back then? And then they developed this idea, well, actually, they knew that. They didn't know what to make of it, and so they wrote it down, and knowing that later we'd figure it out.
Yeah, with a Post-it note on it, it said, Dear Future, you know.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
Yeah, and I think, this came up a little while ago, and I got severely beaten about the face and neck by a couple of people who, they didn't even like the notion that we think of Revelation and Daniel as separate from prophecies, because the difference is, in prophetic literature, we can still change something and we can avoid God's wrath. But generally speaking, in apocalyptic literature, it's already done. It's just people got to see the movie before we did. It was like other people, like John of Patmos in Revelation, saw it having already happened and is just telling us it's just a matter of time until this happens.
Yeah, it becomes a feature of both Judaism and Christianity that everything is going according to plan. And that was originally a source of comfort. You know, so like it seemed like the world is so arbitrary, and why is this happening, and why didn't God prevent this? And one way of solving that problem emotionally is saying, well, actually, it's all part of the plan. And it's all going just like God wanted to. And so, but the end of the plan is very good. And here's what's going to happen at the end. And so it's not an accident that's at the end of the book of Revelation, when all of this craziness, at the end of all the craziness, God brings in a new heaven and a new earth. In other words, in the new Jerusalem descends from heaven, and people then enter into their eternal paradise. And so that's the end of the plan. And so once you think it's all going according to plan, then, well, pandemic's okay. This is part of the plan. And
right.
At the end of it, it's going to be fine.
Yeah. It sounds a little bit like you in one sense. I'm always a little torn. I'm glad that people have scripture that comforts them in times of crisis. I think that's good. And it can inspire their imagination at a time when they may be feeling very dour. And I think that's good. But it's always weird to me when we get into this conversation about, you know, everything is happening exactly the way it's supposed to, because I don't think, I counseled people who have just lost a child, where a drunk driver hit a child, and people come up to them and said, well, God, you know, this was all part of God's plan. And they think that that's supposed to bring them comfort. And it's absolutely a hideous notion that somehow their child had been targeted from the very beginning, and that God was working through drunks.
Yeah, I know.
And I think this kind of bleeds over into that same thing, too. It's a kind of an ambiguous theology that doesn't play very well to the individual.
Well, it often doesn't, and it often doesn't play well to society as a whole, for the reasons I was saying before. Because if this is what God's planning, then there's no reason for us to try to stop
to do anything about it. So in this concept, though, too, and again, there's in the new book, Heaven and Hell: A History of the Afterlife, Bart explains these major shifts over time in how people originally didn't think that there was any kind of afterlife. You lived the life that you had, you enjoyed it, you may regret the fact that you're going to die and it'll all be over, and you know that everybody will think of you fondly, but that's it. To this evolution over thousands of years to where we cling to notions that somehow something special and amazing is going to happen. I hope it does. I still think about that all the time. And as I said last night, I'm banking on the last shall be first. That's my only way in. So I all the people who say they got it worked out, good. You be at the front of the line. I'll be back here where I actually have a chance. But this is where, you know, if we let this shape the way we treat other people or the way we treat a disaster, that's when I think that wasn't what that was written for.
You know, and it doesn't have to be, even if you subscribe to these apocalyptic views that it's all going according to plan and that it's the forces of evil doing this and that, you know, that the way it's, that doesn't necessarily lead to social inaction. I mean, when I was a Christian, I thought that, you know, that in fact things were going according to plan and all that, but I still thought that the world that was controlled by forces of evil, that the forces of evil had to be fought against. I mean, my view is that they're God's enemies, and if I'm on God's side, I'm going to fight them. And so, you know, I'm not going to cave in to poverty and to homelessness and to hunger. And I'm not going to, you know, I'm going to fight because that's bad, and I'm going to fight against everything that's bad. So it doesn't have to lead to that. The problem is it so often does. And especially with very conservative Christians who just don't have a very strong social ethic because they don't think it really matters.
Did that mean when you were younger, before you went to Princeton Theological Seminary, that you would never listen to some of the bumpers I'm playing, like Van Halen or something like that? Did you? I'm really serious.
I was sort of before your time, but
okay. Well, what didn't you listen to then?
I listened to everything. I mean, we always felt guilty about listening to some of the stuff we listened to. But even at Moody Bible Institute, when I was going there, we were playing some pretty hard rock, and it's like people got upset with us. Eventually at Moody Bible Institute, it became the institute. They don't have it anymore, I'm sure, but they instituted a rule about what kind of music you could listen to, because the idea that syncopated music came from the devil had started to kick in.
Wow. Syncopated. Yeah. A music, anything with syncopation.
they defined it in certain ways. It basically meant like serious rock.
Yeah. It's like the old, you know, you know all these, but you know, the old joke about why do Pentecostals don't have sex standing up, as they're afraid people will think they're dancing.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
And this is actually my favorite one. When I was living in the South for a long time, was Jews don't recognize Jesus as the Messiah. Protestants don't recognize the Pope as the head of the church, and Baptists don't recognize each other in liquor stores.
Yeah, that's good.
And I remember that joke because once I was walking, I have a very good friend who I really loved working with him, and he was very devout, and he would often talk about, you know, devil's music and that sort of thing. And I actually bumped into him walking out of an AC/DC concert, and the look on his face, he was so busted. And he just looked at me like, ah, and I'm like, I think this is interesting because you know, as you made a point to say, when you were a Christian, there are a lot of people, and I always say this when you're on, there are a lot of people who will go, oh, well, see, this is why he's saying this. He's against the church. He's trying to bring down the church. He hates the church. And this is why he's interpreting these things this way. And I say, theologians who I know who are still very much a part of their faith would say the same things about the Bible, that biblical scholarship is pretty uniform. You're not that far out of the mainstream in the things that you're mentioning in heaven and hell.
No, most of the things I say are actually in the mainstream.
Yeah.
The big difference is that the mainstream refuses to say these things because they're afraid that their audience will be offended. And so, you know, you went to seminary. I mean, pastors learn this kind of stuff in seminary, but very rarely do they tell their congregations because
it doesn't preach.
It doesn't preach, and you know, sometimes it's just pure job security.
Right.
But sometimes it's also, you know, that they've got pastoral concerns, and they try to, you know, they want to comfort people rather than shake them up. And I get that. But it does seem to me that in addition to a pastoral role, there's an educational role, and that people have the right to knowledge. Knowledge is good. It's not bad. And so people who know these things really should say them more. When someone like me, when I say them, people, you know, find it offensive. Well, I'm not meaning to be offensive. I'm just trying to give knowledge. And you can still be a Christian and think these things.
Right.
Then you'd be a knowledgeable Christian instead of an ignorant one. Well, that'd be good.
Right. Yeah. And I think this is fair because, and I think your point about it's off. You have to be, as a pastor, you have to be aware of who's signing your check. And so it's much easier, as I describe it, to be a drive-by prophet if you're not on the payroll, which is why I chose to be non-stipendiary, because I always feel like I can speak my mind, and my family's financial security wasn't at stake, right? And that's sad. It's a sad truth, because I think the beauty of taking the Bible seriously is taking it apart.
Well, you know, the thing is that, you know, knowledge is not easy. And people like easy answers, and you see it nowhere more than when it comes to religion, where people just like easy answers or things that they're comfortable with. And so, you know, so when it comes to the Bible, people assume that everything they've ever heard, or, you know, they hear something and they think, oh, that's a track, I think that's probably right, instead of actually doing the hard work of looking into it. But, you know, we know from other realms that you've got to do the serious work. I mean, you can't solve a problem with a virus by wishful thinking or just kind of spreading rumors. You've got to develop a vaccine, and that takes work.
Right.
And so, you know, and so if it applies in science, it applies to all science. The word science, I mean, the whole idea of science is that it has to do with knowledge. And you know, the word science actually means knowledge. Well, knowledge applies to all fields, not just the hard sciences, and so we ought to be scientific in how we look at everything.
Yeah, and I think this is at the core, that belief is at the core of heaven and hell, a history of the afterlife. Let's talk about some of the things that end up in that absolutely are not in the Bible, that in your experience most people think, or many people believe, are that's actually in the Bible, but it's not.
About the afterlife, you mean, or
yeah,
generally?
About the afterlife. If it's general, we could be here all day. But I mean, specifically about the afterlife. What do you think? What are the most common things that people think are in there that aren't?
Well, people commonly think that Jesus preached about hell, and that Jesus thought that your soul would go to one place or another. And you can see why they would think that, because of their Bible translations and the kind of typical ways people read them. But so it takes about a chapter for me to show that Jesus actually didn't teach that. And so that's a major thing. The idea that the soul exists apart from the body. That is not, there are a couple of passages that could be taken that way. The vast majority of the entire 66 books of the Bible absolutely don't have that view. And the passages that do seem to have that view are problematic for other reasons that, that you know, take a lot of explaining. And the idea that the kingdom of God, when Jesus talks about, here's a big one. When Jesus talks about the kingdom of God, people assume that he means the place that your soul is going to go when you die, that you're going to go to heaven. And so when you enter the kingdom of God, means your soul goes to heaven. It is absolutely not what he meant. He was talking about a kingdom here on earth, a real kingdom here on earth, that people who would enter into bodily, it would be a return to paradise, just as God made the Garden of Eden here on earth, and people mucked it up. He's going to restore the world to paradise, and people then are going to enter it again, and it's going to be here. It's not something that your soul goes to when you die. So that's right. That's a very common misconception, I think.
And I think there's a lot of things that are in Dante's Inferno, which people think are in the Bible. And it really had much more to do with the imagination of a great writer who may have been biblically inspired. But, you know, we just sort of accept them because it's become part of our art, part of our movies, you know, just part of the way we
look
at the
world. It's interesting because people do accept, you know, the idea of the inferno hell and paradiso, heaven. But most people in our world don't accept purgatorio, purgatory. And so they pick and choose even with Dante, just as they did
right.
With the Bible. But is Dante has certainly inspired how people understand heaven and hell, just like Milton has inspired how people understand the devil. So
how do we, and Milton's another great example of this, but where does this idea of us being in hell, that it's, you know, that we, our genitals will be roasted over a fire and all of the horrible things that would happen to us, where does that come from? Where does that belief trace back to?
This is actually the key question, because in my book, what I argue is that Jesus and the Apostle Paul and the book of Revelation do not believe in eternal torment at all. They believe that some people will be rewarded when the resurrection happens. People will be raised from the dead, and some people will be given an eternal reward, a bodily reward here on earth, as they enter into the kingdom of God. What about all the people who were opposed to God, which for these authors would be most people? They are not going to be tortured forever. They're going to be destroyed. They will be literally annihilated, and that's their punishment. It's a death penalty. It's described as eternal punishment, and so people think that means that they're going to be eternally tormented. They're not going to be eternally tormented. The eternal punishment is that they're going to be annihilated, and they're not going to be brought back. It's a punishment that's going to last forever. It's an eternal death. I mean, not that they're going to be punished, but they'll be destroyed. What ended up happening...
Hang on a second there. That's where we'll get... And we'll give the numbers, too, so hang on. What ended up happening, ellipsis... Right there. But I think that was the main point, too, that you will be written out of the book of God. Heaven and Hell, it's a great new book by Bart Ehrman, and we'll run the numbers here so you can join the conversation with your questions and comments next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.